proceed to the third case, Enclosures v. Block & Company. Mr. Warson.
Good morning, Your Honors. Matt Warson for Enclosures. I'm struck by the unfairness of the result reached below. Here you have Enclosures, newly incorporated, has just reduced to practice a tablet enclosure, a device that it'll later receive a patent on, when it's approached by Block at a trade show here in Chicago. At that trade show, Block came to Enclosures. Block encouraged Enclosures to share its design files. The parties then executed the confidentiality covenant. The parties then spent the next year, Enclosures working with Block to conform its design to the Block manufacturing capability. Moreover, Enclosures shares its pricing information. All of this cooperation, all of this information was shared pursuant to that confidentiality covenant. It was shared pursuant to assurances from Block that the two were going to jointly develop this product and bring it to the market together. Now, at precisely the time at which Block was ready to walk on its own and launch its competing tablet enclosure, which is a knockoff of the Enclosures product, Block kicks Enclosures to the curb and starts competing with Enclosures, selling this knockoff product for $60 less per unit. Now, we believe it's an unfair result below, and happily for Enclosures, it's inconsistent with Illinois law. I would emphasize today, Your Honors, the Jones v. Ulrich case that we cite in our briefs. There, that's a 1950 decision from the Illinois Appellate Court that bears a remarkable resemblance to the facts of this case. There you have an inventor wishing to commercialize his invention before a patent issued. He goes to a manufacturer. The manufacturer proceeds to develop the invention on the manufacturer's own behalf and starts competing with the inventor. Now, the court in that case, the Jones case, held that there's an implied duty to hold the invention in confidence, and that based on that duty, the manufacturer breached that duty by taking the invention for himself. Now, more specifically on the contract claim, what we're appealing here, Your Honors, is the holding that Enclosures failed to show that Enclosures took, quote, any reasonable efforts to maintain the secrecy of its design files. That's at page 12 of our appendix. There's just no support for that finding that Enclosures didn't take any reasonable efforts. Let's start with the confidentiality covenant itself, which Enclosures required before it would disclose any confidential information to Block. And I would emphasize for Your Honors the really extraordinary protection that the confidentiality covenant offered to Enclosures. It's at paragraph 7, page 25 of our appendix. The confidentiality covenant has a 5-year term to it. And it's not just 5 years. It's 5 years from the date at which Block terminates or wishes to terminate the confidentiality covenant. And on this record, Your Honors, there's no evidence that that was ever done. Beyond the confidentiality covenant, at the very beginning of this litigation, Enclosures submitted the affidavit of Mr. Daniel McKean, in which Mr. McKean testifies to Enclosure's policy to hold its information in confidence. The district court, in its opinion, simply never addresses this testimony. More than that, we also have evidence from Dulson, which was the manufacturer of a prior version of the Rhino Elite. At page 41 of our appendix, one Mr. Simich of the Dulson firm, in response to a question of whether or not Dulson has a policy of holding its customers' information in confidence, Mr. Simich responds emphatically, absolutely. If I could move to the fiduciary duty claim and specifically what it is we appeal here, it's Judge Deryagian's holding, quote, "The record does not indicate that Enclosures shared its profits with Block. There was no joint sharing of profits." That's at pages 14 and 15 of our appendix. That holding, while citing no evidence for its proposition, ignores two key pieces of evidence that we had in the record and that were simply ignored. First, there's a memo from a Block executive, Mr. Kaufman, to the chairman of the board, Ken Block. That's at pages 31 and 32 of our appendix. That memorandum lays out in detail the terms of the partnership, the oral partnership that these parties entered into. But importantly for our appeal, that memo contains a line item that Enclosures was entitled to approximately $33 on each sale of the Rhino Elite to a Block customer. That evidence is corroborated then by an email from one Mr. Niece of the Block firm to
Why is that sufficient to constitute sharing of profits for purposes of establishing a partnership? Usually, what we expect to see is payment based on a percent of sale rather than a specific amount per unit. That suggests not a partnership, but just an arm's length contractual relationship. If your client is paid on a basis of a specific amount per unit of sale as opposed to a percent of profits,
I think that defeats
a partnership.
If you read in the entirety of the Kaufman memo, it lays out a number of terms and not simply what Enclosures was entitled to.
Right, but
on
one of the things
sale.
You have to show, one of the factors that is critical to the establishment of a partnership is the community of interest in profits, such that you're sharing profits in a way that suggests that this is a partnership and not just an arm's length contractual relationship.
Right. What we point
to trigger a fiduciary duty. I mean, that standard's pretty high.
What we point to, Your Honor, specifically in that Kaufman memo, is, for example, Block granting the right to Enclosures to audit cost information and sales information.
How is that establishing profit sharing?
Your Honor,
As opposed to just we'll pay you this amount per unit that you manufacture.
Well, our theory is that to the extent the parties could work together and drive costs down, the $33 per unit was not fixed. And so if you add on the rights that Block granted to Enclosures, which would cut against just a mere arm's length transaction, but the Kaufman memo, almost in colorful terms, says our records are an open book. And so you have a relationship where these two entities were working together to most efficiently produce, distribute, and sell the tablet Enclosure. And with this collection of rights, we believe it's enough to make out a community of interest. Now, our appeal of Judge Deryagian's decision, and his holding is quite narrow and limited. It's just that there's no evidence of a sharing of profits. And we believe that the Kaufman memo, all of its terms read together, makes out a sharing of profits in a joint effort to sell the Rhino Elite. And we believe that the niece email to McKean, page 34 of our appendix, works to corroborate the Kaufman email. There, Mr. Niece, on behalf of Block, says, the net profit on each unit sold to third parties for enclosures was $33.75, and that agreement has not changed to date. There, you know, Block relies on testimony from witnesses testifying that there was no sharing of profits, but that really underscores the error here, and that perhaps there were some facts in the column of no sharing of profits, but we're pointing to two pieces of evidence that are in the column of there was a sharing of profits. This evidence was simply ignored, and that's the basis of our appeal. Without further questions, I'll reserve the rest of my time.
All right, thank you, Mr. Warson. Mr. White?
Good morning, Your Honor. James White on behalf of Block & Company, the appellee and cross-appellant in this court. I'd like to just start with straightening out for the record a couple of points that Mr. Warson made in the initial opening argument. Number one, he made it sound like there was some sinister plot to create a product on our own without their knowledge in violation of what he calls, quote unquote, the partnership. And really, if you look at our record, there in the draft agreements that were negotiated in July that failed, that was the purpose of the whole meeting, is to enter into an agreement with respect to creating an enclosure for a tablet. There's a paragraph in there that allows for Block and Company to make its own product as long as it didn't infringe any of their patents. And more importantly, in the summary judgment motions below, there is a Block statement of facts that is answered by Enclosures as undisputed. And it reads, one of the draft agreements provided that Block could manufacture its own enclosure product as long as it did not infringe on any Enclosure patent. Enclosure response, undisputed. So the fact of the matter is, you could make a product yourself, and in fact, they did. And they have never been accused of patent infringement. The second point is, Judge Duryagin below, when he dealt with the breach of contract, he found that there was no evidence of any reasonable efforts made by the plaintiff to protect its confidential information and alleged confidential information. And with respect to Mr. Simich's testimony, there was no understanding with Mr. Simich, and the record is clear from Mr. Simich's testimony that's in our brief, our opening brief, wherein he is asked whether there was an NDA signed, and he says, no, we don't do that. We don't have any of that stuff. He said, what we do is we just keep everything confidential that a customer gives to us. And then the next question is, did you ever discuss this with Enclosures? No. Never discussed it with them all. And now, Enclosures would like to rely on that as evidence of their taking reasonable efforts. And then there is the point, and it's made in their brief, that they rely on the preliminary injunction as evidence of their good faith in pursuing this claim. Well, he's referenced and cited to Dan McKeon's affidavit. And Dan McKeon is a, he is the acting principal, if you will, of Enclosures in this whole deal, or working relationship. He lives in town here, or in Michigan, excuse me. But in any event, McKeon's affidavit is in support of the preliminary injunction. That's when it's filed. And paragraph 9 says, Enclosures doesn't do anything without an NDA. To the extent that Judge Duryagian relied on that, it just turns out to be not true. The evidence is contrary to that. Ian LeBlanc, the designer for Enclosures, of the PET tablet, the first tablet, he has no discussion, there's no evidence of any discussion with him about confidentiality. He has it on his home computer. He has the SolidWorks file on his home computer. Then you deal with Raytac, was the corporation that actually did the manufacturing of the first Enclosure product prior to the meeting with my client, Block & Company. There's no evidence of any discussion with him with respect to an NDA or confidentiality with respect to the product. And then you have Dawson, and we've just talked about Mr. Simich's testimony, that he never even talked to them about keeping it confidential, yet they want to rely on that. There just simply isn't any evidence at all of any reasonable efforts taken by Enclosures with respect to their alleged confidential information.
Isn't this product fairly easy to reverse engineer anyway? So there's a question about whether the design was actually confidential, apart from whether there were efforts taken.
In the end,
so?
that's what Judge Duryagian came to. His conclusion was, this isn't confidential, therefore there's no breach of contract. And in fact, you're right, Judge Sykes, because the Rhino product is on the market in July of 2011. Okay. We don't get on the market with the Rhino Elite. Only difference between those two products is the Rhino enclosure, which encloses the tablet and secures it to wherever it is so the customer can't walk away with it. That has a screw mechanism that locks it. The Rhino Elite is the same product, except now it's got a key lock. So before we get on the market with the Rhino Elite that we manufacture for them, the Rhino has been on since, well, actually it's been on since before our meeting with them, I believe, in May of 2011. And yes, it's easy to reverse engineer. Michael Toomer, defendant's expert witness, said, you could reverse engineer this in 13 hours or less. You could make it from scratch for probably about 40 hours with an engineer, mechanical engineer. And it would only cost about $2,600. With respect to the Kaufman to Ken Block email that Mr. Warzen talked about, that particular email, if you read it, and he gave you a cite to it, but it's in the record below. That email, he even says the $33.75 is a license fee. It's not profit. And with respect to the Niece email, and Scott Niece is trying to work out a deal where he says in this email, listen, instead of us paying you $53 and you paying us $19.25 back for manufacturing it, we'll just send you the difference between the $33, the $53, and the $19.25, which is the manufacturing cost. We'll send you $33.75. Okay? That's always been your net profit on this. Okay? Now, that's different than sharing of profits. He actually, in the next sentence, he talks about the $33.75 as the buyback. But that's different than actual sharing of profits. What you have in our opening brief, and you will see it in the citation to the record, It's in the, I don't know, page 34, 35. You have Daniel McCann at his deposition testifying that, no, that's not sharing of profits. We never share profits. Block didn't share profits with us. We didn't share profits with them. And he is the active principal in this enclosures business. Then you have Kemper Barkhurst, another principal. There's three principals, Dan Gorman, Kemper Barkhurst, and McKee. Same question, same answer. No sharing of profits, none at all. No, everybody kept their own revenue. And then you have, in I believe it's August of 2011, when the negotiations break down after they've gone through three tries at this, you have an email from Gorman, the third principal, to, I gotta get the name right, Kaufman, who is our executive, and that email says, it lays out the buy and sell agreement. We're gonna pay you, you're gonna pay, we'll pay you $19.25 for every enclosure you manufacture for us, that we sell to our customers. And you pay us $33.75 to buy back an enclosure that you want to sell to your customers through the distribution channels. He never mentions the word profit. So you've got three principals, one in an email, albeit, but two under oath saying there's no profit sharing. And yet, Mr. Worzen and Enclosure would like this court to believe that a strained interpretation of Scott Neese's affidavit trumps that testimony. It just can't. No reasonable fact finder, no jury would return a verdict that there was sharing of profits and a partnership. There is no community of interest in profits in this. It was strictly a manufacturing on a purchase order and the buyback for ones that we wanted to sell. In fact, Ronald Barrow kind of finished it all off. He's their expert. In his report, he says, there is no sharing of profits. There just wasn't. His understanding was just revenue to Block. This case is a case that actually should never have been filed, frankly. And when it was filed, it should have been settled early on. In March of 2013, Block told Enclosures we had $5,100 in sales. $5,100. Barrow even testified, in his report, says that's only worth about $2,600 in profit. Yet their demand is $1.75 million, $800,000 in their total demand, $200,000 for our profits, $500,000 for attorney's fees, and $100,000 for the design, to make the design. Okay, $800,000, you triple it, you get $2.4 million, you give us a discount, and you get $1.75 million, and we offer them $110,000 on a product that, even if we were guilty, it's only worth about $2,600. That is not good faith. It is bad faith. It is bad faith because their evidence was objectively specious. You can infer subjective bad faith from that, and their persistence and pursuit of this claim, all the four counts, but especially if you look at the fiduciary duty, that's the quintessential example. I've just explained all of that. That the fact that you have all of these witnesses testifying that there's no profits, their own principals and their expert, And then you have them coming into this court saying that they are entitled to have a reversal of this. We would ask, Block and Company would ask that this court affirm the judgment entered by Judge Diaz below, reverse the denial of fees, and remand it to the district court for an assessment of reasonable attorney's fees. Unless there are any questions, thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. White. Mr. Worsen.
The ILG case, Supreme Court of Illinois, establishes that one in enclosure's position to take reasonable efforts simply must disclose its confidential information with the understanding that it will be treated in confidence. That holding makes the Simich testimony relevant. Now, Block contends or really contorts that holding to really require something more, that enclosures at least have an oral confidentiality agreement with Dalson, for example, but that the ILG case just doesn't stand for that proposition. On the issue of there being only $5,100 in sales, we brought this action primarily to obtain injunctive relief, which we did on the contract claim. And that contract claim has a broad indemnity clause. And so what we sought in order to settle this case was reimbursement of all costs under that contract, namely for obtaining the preliminary injunction. Now, beyond that, we also seek restitution for the over a year in time that we spent with Block based on Block's assurances. And now, just to address the cross appeal, Judge Deryagian at that hearing held, I know the case. I did not find anything that comes remotely close that there was no basis for the lawsuit or that it was in bad faith. That's at page 7 of Block's appendix. Now, Judge Deryagian at that hearing is essentially warning Block that it has no basis to move for sanctions. He said that the summary judgment opinion never used the terminology bad faith. It never said that we had a total lack of evidence. All he held in his summary judgment opinion was that undisputed facts led to the conclusion that Block was entitled to a judgment. Judge Deryagian said that he may be reversed on appeal. This is simply not a case of bad faith. And finally, Judge Deryagian, having referenced that he doesn't talk in terms of bad faith in the opinion, he again explicitly holds on the record there's been no bad faith on the part of plaintiffs. Now, we do make something of the fact that we obtained a preliminary injunction in this case. We have been unable to find, and I would expect that there isn't a case where plaintiff obtains a preliminary injunction and plaintiff and its counsel are later sanctioned for maintaining that action. In Block's world, I should have advised my client to dismiss the case after having obtained a preliminary injunction. That doesn't make sense to me. We believe that Judge Deryagian should be affirmed on the cross appeal. Thank you.
Thanks, Warson. Thanks to all counsel. The case is taken under advisement.